No complete list of the sitters is available, nor was there any proper collective report, the only record being a very imperfect and inconclusive one from the secretary, M. Courtier. The investigators included some very distinguished persons, including Charles Richer, Monsieur and Madame Curie, Messrs. Bergson, Perrin, Professor d'Arsenal of the Collège de France, who was president of the society, Count de Gramont, Professor Charpentier, and Principal Debine of the Sorbonne. The actual result could not have been disastrous to the medium, since Professor Richer has recorded his endorsement of the reality of her psychic powers, but the strange superficial tricks of Yu Zhapiu are recorded in the subsequent account of her career, and we can well imagine the disconcerting effect which they would have upon those to whom such things were new. There is included in the report a sort of conversation among the sitters in which they talk the matter over, most of them being in a very nebulous and non-committal frame of mind. It cannot be claimed that any new light was shed upon the medium, or any new argument provided either for the skeptic or for the believer. Dr. Jelly, however, who has probably gone as deeply as anyone else into psychic science, claims that lay experiences he does not say the reporter constitute a valuable contribution to the subject. He bases this upon the fact that the results chronicled do often strikingly confirm those obtained in his own Institut M.A. copyright psychic working with Klusky, Guzik, and other mediums. The differences, he says, are in details and never in essentials. The control of the hands was the same in either case, both the hands being always held. This was easier in the case of the later mediums, especially with Klusky in trance, while Yu Zhapiu was usually a very restless individual. There seems to be a halfway condition which was characteristic of Yu Zhapiu, and which has been observed by the author in the case of Frau Silbert, Evan Powell, and other mediums, where the person seems normal, and yet as peculiarly susceptible to suggestion or other mental impressions. A suspicion of fraud may very easily be aroused in this condition, for the general desire on the part of the audience that something should occur reacts with great force upon the unreasoning mind of the medium. An amateur who had some psychic power has assured the author that it needs considerable inhibition to keep such impulses in check and to await the real power from outside. In this report we read, the two hands, feet, and knees of Yu Zhapiu being controlled, the table is raised suddenly, all 4 feet leaving the ground. Yu Zhapiu closes her fists and holds them towards the table, which is then completely raised from the floor 5 times in succession, 5 raps being also given. It is again completely raised whilst each of Yu Zhapiu's hands is on the head of a sitter. It is raised to a height of 1 foot from the floor and suspended in the air for 7 seconds, while Yu Zhapiu kept her hand on the table, and a lighted candle was placed under the table, and so on, with even more conclusive tests with table and other phenomena. The timidity of the report was satirized by the great French spiritualist, Gabriel Delanne. He says, the reporter keeps saying it seems and it appears, like a man who is not sure of what he is relating. Those who held 43 SA copyright answers, with good eyes and apparatus for verification, ought to have a settled opinion or, at least, to be able to say, if they regard a certain phenomenon as fraudulent, that at a given SA copyright answer they had seen the medium in the act of tricking. But there is nothing of the sort. The reader is left in uncertainty, a vague suspicion hovers over everything, though not supported on any serious grounds. Commenting on this, Light says, Delanne shows by extracts from the report itself that some of the experiments succeeded even when the fullest test precautions were taken, such as using lamp black to discover whether Yu Zhapiu really touched the objects moved. Yet the report deliberately discounts these direct and positive observations by instancing cases occurring at other times and places in which Yu Zhapiu was said or believed to have unduly influenced the phenomena. The Courier report will prove more and more plainly to be what we have already called it, a monument of ineptitude, and the reality of Yu Zhapiu's phenomena cannot be seriously called in question by the meaningless phrases with which it is liberally garnished. What may be called a collective investigation of a medium, Mrs. Grandin, the wife of a doctor in Boston, was undertaken in the years 1923 to 1925 by a committee chosen by the Scientific American and afterwards by a small committee of Harvard men with Dr. Shapley, the astronomer, at their head. The controversy over these inquiries is still raging, and the matter has been referred to in the chapter which deals with great modern mediums. It may briefly be stated that of the Scientific American inquirers, the secretary, Mr. Malcolm Bird, and Dr. Hayard Carrington announced their complete conversion. The others gave no clear decision, which involved the humiliating admission that after numerous sittings under their own conditions and in the presence of constant phenomena, they could not tell whether they were being cheated or not. The defect of the committee was that no experienced spiritualist who was familiar with psychic conditions was upon it. Dr. Prince was very deaf, while Dr. McDougall was in a position where his whole academic career would obviously be endangered by the acceptance of an unpopular explanation. The same remark applies to Dr. Shapley's committee, which was all composed of budding scientists. Without imputing conscious mental dishonesty, there is a subconscious drag towards the course of safety. Reading the report of these gentlemen with their signed acquiescence at each sitting with the result, and their final verdict of fraud, one cannot discover any normal way in which they have reached their conclusions. On the other hand, the endorsements of the mediumship by folk who had no personal reasons for extreme caution were frequent and enthusiastic. Dr. Mark Richardson of Boston reported that he had sat more than 300 times, and had no doubt at all about the results. The author has seen numerous photographs of the ectoplasmic flow from Marjorie, and has no hesitation, on comparing it with similar photographs taken in Europe, in saying that it is unquestionably genuine, and that the future will justify the medium as against her unreasonable critics. Appendix Notes to Chapter 4: Evidence of the Haunting of the Hartsville House Before the Fox Family Occupied It. Mrs. Ann Pulver certifies, "I was acquainted with Mr. and Mrs. Bell, who occupied the house in 1844. I used to call on them frequently. My warping bars were in their chamber, and I used to go there to do my work. One morning when I went there, Mrs. Bell told me that she felt very bad, that she had not slept much, if any, the night before. When I asked her what the matter was, she said she didn't know but what it was the fidgets, but she thought she heard somebody walking about from one room to another, and that she heard Mr. Bell get up and fasten down all the windows. She said she felt more safe after that. I asked her what she thought it was. She said it might be rats. I heard her speak about hearing noises after that, which she could not account for." Miss Lucretia Pulver gave testimony, "I lived in this house all one winter, in the family of Mr. Bell. I worked for them part of the time, and part of the time I boarded and went to school. I lived there about 3 months. During the latter part of the time that I was there, I heard this knocking frequently in the bedroom, under the foot of the bed. I heard it a number of nights, as I slept in the bedroom all the time that I stayed there. One night I thought I heard a man walking in the buttery. This buttery is near the bedroom, with a stairway between. Miss Aurelia Lucy stayed with me on that night. She also heard the noise, and we were both much frightened, and got up and fastened down the windows and fastened the door. It sounded as if a person walked through the buttery, down cellar, and part way across the cellar bottom, and there the noise would cease. There was no one else in the house at this time, except my little brother, who was asleep in the same room with us. This was about 12 o'clock, I should think. We did not go to bed until after 11, and had not been asleep when we heard the noise. Mr. and Mrs. Bell had gone to Loch Berlin, to be gone until the next day. Thus it is proved that strange sounds were heard in the house in 1844. Another family named Weekman lived there in 1846-7, and they had a similar experience. Statement of Mrs. Hannah Weekman: "I have heard about the mysterious noises that have been heard in the house now occupied by Mr. Fox. We used to live in the same house. We lived there about a year and a half and moved from there to the house we now occupy. About a year ago, while we were living there, we heard someone, as we supposed, rapping on the outside door. I had just got into bed, but my husband had not. He went and opened it, and said that there was no one there. He came back, and was about getting into bed when we heard the rapping on the door again. He then went to the door and opened it, and said that he could see no one, although he stepped out a little way. He then came back and got into bed. He was quite angry, he thought 'twas some of the neighboring boys trying to disturb us, and said that they might knock away, but they would not fool him, or something of that kind. The knocking was heard again, and after a while he got up and went to the door and went out. I told him not to go outdoors, for perhaps somebody wanted to get him out and hurt him. He came back, and said he could see nothing. We heard a good deal of noise during the night, we could hardly tell where it was. It sounded sometimes as if someone was walking in the cellar. But the house was old, and we thought it might be the rattling of loose boards, or something of that kind. A few nights afterwards, one of our little girls, who slept in the bedroom where the noises are now heard, woke us all up by screaming very loud. My husband and I, and our hired girl, got up immediately to see what was the matter. She sat up in bed, crying and screaming, and it was some time before we could find out what the matter was. She said that something had been moving about, over her head and face here, that it was cold, and she did not know what it was. She said that she felt it all over her, but she was most alarmed at feeling it on her face. She was very much frightened. This was between 12 and 1 o'clock at night. She got up and got into bed with us, and it was a long time before she could go to sleep. It was several days before we could get her to sleep in that room again. She was 8 years old at that time. Nothing else happened to me during the time that we lived there, but my husband told me that one night he heard someone call him by name, somewhere in the house he did not know where but could never find out where or what it was that night. I was not at home that night. I was sitting up with a sick person. We did not think the house was haunted at that time. Hannah Weekman, April 11, 1848. Statement of Michael Weekman. I am the husband of Hannah Weekman. We used to live in the house now occupied by Mr. Fox, in which they say strange noises are heard. We lived there about a year and a half. One evening, about bedtime, I heard the rapping. I supposed it was someone knocking at the door who wanted to come in. I did not bid him come in, as I usually do, but went to the door. I did not find anyone there, but went back, and just as I was getting into bed I heard the rapping again and opened the door quick, but could see no one there. I stepped out a step or two, but could see no one about there. I then went back and got into bed. I thought someone was making game of me. After a few minutes I heard the knocking again, and after waiting a few minutes and still hearing it, I got up and went to the door. This time I went clear out and looked around the house, but could find no one. I then stepped back and shut the door, and held on to the latch, thinking that if there was anyone there I would catch them at it. In a minute or two I heard the rapping again. My hand was on the door, and the knocking appeared to be on the door. I could feel it jar with the raps. I instantly opened the door and sprang out, but there was no one in sight. I then went round the house again, but could find no one, as before. My wife told me I had better not go out of doors, as it might be someone that wanted to hurt me. I did not know what to think of it, it seemed so strange and unaccountable. He here relates the case of the little girl being frightened, as given above. One night after this, about midnight, I was awake, and heard my name called. It sounded as if it was on the south side of the room. I sat up in bed and listened, but did not hear it again. I did not get out of bed, but waited to see if it would be repeated. My wife was not at home that night. I told her of it afterwards, and she said she guessed I had been dreaming. My wife used to be frightened quite often by hearing strange noises in and about the house. I have heard so much from men in whom I place confidence about these noises that are now heard, that, taken in connection with what I heard, I cannot account for it, unless it is a supernatural appearance. I am willing to make affidavit to the above facts if necessary. Signed, Michael Weekman. April 11, 1848. Extract from Horace Greeley's article in the New York Tribune giving his opinion of the Fox sisters and their mediumship. Mrs. Fox and her three daughters left our city yesterday on their return to Rochester, after a stay here of some weeks, during which they have subjected the mysterious influence, by which they seem to be accompanied, to every reasonable test, and to the keen and critical scrutiny of hundreds who have chosen to visit them, or whom they have been invited to visit. The rooms which they occupied at the hotel have been repeatedly searched and scrutinized, they have been taken without an hour's notice into houses they had never before entered, they have been all unconsciously placed on a glass surface concealed under the carpet in order to interrupt electrical vibrations, they have been disrobed by a committee of ladies appointed without notice, and insisting that neither of them should leave the room until the investigation has been made, etc., etc. Yet we believe no one, to this moment, pretends that he has detected either of them in producing or causing the rappings, nor do we think any of their contemners has invented a plausible theory to account for the production of these sounds, nor the singular intelligence which, certainly at times, has seemed to be manifest through them. Some 10 or 12 days since they gave up their rooms at the hotel and devoted the remainder of their sojourn here to visiting several families, to which they had been invited by persons interested in the subject, and subjecting the singular influence to a closer, calmer examination than could be given to it at a hotel, and before casual companies of strangers, drawn together by vague curiosity more than rational interest, or predetermined and invincible hostility. Our own dwelling was among those they thus visited, not only submitting to, but courting, the fullest and keenest inquiry with regard to the alleged manifestations from the spirit world, by which they were attended. We devoted what time we could spare from our duties out of 3 days to this subject, and it would be the basest cowardice not to say that we are convinced beyond a doubt of their perfect integrity and good faith in the premises. Whatever may be the origin or cause of the rappings, the ladies in whose presence they occur do not make them. We tested this thoroughly and to our entire satisfaction. Their conduct and bearing is as unlike that of deceivers as possible, and we think no one acquainted with them could believe them at all capable of engaging in so daring, impious, and shameful a juggle as this would be if they caused the sounds. And it is not possible that such a juggle should have been so long perpetrated in public. A juggler performs one feat quickly and hurries on to another. He does not devote weeks after weeks to the same thing over and over, deliberately, in full view of hundreds who sit beside or confronting him in broad daylight, not to enjoy but to detect his trick. A deceiver naturally avoids conversation on the subject of his knavery, but these ladies converse freely and fully with regard to the origin of these rappings in their dwellings years ago, the various sensations they caused, the neighborhood excitement created, the progress of the developments of what they have seen, heard and experienced from first to last. If all were false, they could not fail to have involved themselves ere this in a labyrinth of blasting contradictions, as each separately gives accounts of the most astonishing developments at this or that time. Persons foolish enough so to commit themselves without reserve or caution could not have deferred a thorough self-exposure for a single week. Of course, a variety of opinions of so strange a matter would naturally be formed by the various persons who have visited them, and we presume that those who have merely run into their room for an hour or so, and listened, among a huddle of strangers, to a medley of questions are not all admitting a very profitable answer so put to certain invisible intelligences, and answered by rappings, or singular noises on the floor, table, etc., as the alphabet was called over, or otherwise, would naturally go away, perhaps puzzled, probably disgusted, rarely convinced. It is hardly possible that a matter, ostensibly so grave, could be presented under circumstances less favorable to conviction. But of those who have enjoyed proper opportunities for a full investigation, We believe that fully 3/4 are convinced, as we are, that these singular sounds and seeming manifestations are not produced by Mrs. Fox and her daughters, nor by any human being connected with them. How they are caused, and whence they proceed, are questions which open a much wider field of inquiry, with whose waymarks we do not profess to be familiar. He must be well acquainted with the arcana of the universe, who shall presume dogmatically to decide that these manifestations are natural or supernatural. The ladies say that they are informed that this is but the beginning of a new era, or economy, in which spirits clothed in the flesh are to be more closely palpably connected with those who have put on immortality, that manifestations have already appeared in many other families and destined to be diffused and rendered clearer, until all who will may communicate freely with their friends who have shuffled off this mortal coil. Of all this we know nothing, and shall guess nothing. But if we were simply to print, which we shall not, the questions asked and answers we received, during a 2 hours uninterrupted conference with the rappers, we should at once be accused of having done so expressly to sustain the theory which regards these manifestations as the utterances of departed spirits. H.G. Note to Chapter 6 Pen Picture of Lake Harris by Lawrence Oliphant. There was a remarkable alternation of vivacity and deliberation about the movements of Mr. Massillon. His voice seemed pitched in two different keys, the effect of which was, when he changed them, to make one seem a distant echo of the other, a species of ventriloquistic phenomenon which was calculated to impart a sudden and not altogether pleasant shock to the nerves of the listeners. When he talked with what I may term his near voice, he was generally rapid and vivacious. When he exchanged it for his far-off one, he was solemn and impressive. His hair, which had once been raven black, was now streaked with grey, but it was still thick and fell in a massive wave over his ears, and nearly to his shoulders, giving him something of a leonine aspect. His brow was overhanging and bushy, and his eyes were like revolving lights in two dark caverns, so fitfully did they seem to emit flashes and then lose all expression. Like his voice, they too had a near and a far-off expression, which could be adjusted to the required focus like a telescope, growing smaller and smaller as though in an effort to project the sight beyond the limits of natural vision. At such times they would be so entirely devoid of all appreciation of outward objects as to produce almost the impression of blindness, when suddenly the focus would change, the pupils expand, and rays flash from them like lightning from a thundercloud, giving an unexpected and extraordinary brilliancy to a face which seemed promptly to respond to the summons. The general cast of countenance, the upper part of which, were it not for the depth of the eye sockets, would have been strikingly handsome, was decidedly Semitic, and in repose the general effect was almost statuesque in its calm fixedness. The mouth was partially concealed by a heavy moustache and long iron-grey beard, but the transition from repose to animation revealed an extraordinary flexibility in those muscles which had a moment before appeared so rigid, and the whole character of the countenance was altered as suddenly as the expression of the eye. It would perhaps be prying too much into the secrets of nature, or, at all events, into the secrets of Mr. Massillon's nature, to inquire whether this lightening and darkening of the countenance was voluntary or not. In a lesser degree it is a common phenomenon with us all. The effect of one class of emotions is, vulgarly speaking, to make a man look black, and of another to make him look bright. The peculiarity of Mr. Massillon was that he could look so much blacker and brighter than most people, and made the change of expression with such extraordinary rapidity and intensity that it seemed a sort of facial legerdemain, and suggested the suspicion that it might be an acquired faculty. There was, moreover, another change which he apparently had the power of working on his countenance, which affects other people involuntarily, and which generally, especially in the case of the fair sex, does so very much against their will. Mr. Massillon had the faculty of looking very much older 1 hour than he did the next. There were moments when a careful study of his wrinkles and of his dull, faded-looking eyes would lead you to put him down at 80 if he was a day, and there were others when his flashing glance, expanding nostril, broad, smooth brow and mobile mouth would make a rejuvenating combination that would for a moment convince you that you had been at least 25 years out in your first estimate. These rapid contrasts were calculated to arrest the attention of the most casual observer, and to produce a sensation which was not altogether pleasant when first one made his acquaintance. It was not exactly mistrust, for both manners were perfectly frank and natural, so much as perplexity. He seemed to be two opposite characters rolled into one, and to be presenting undesigningly a curious moral and physiological problem for solution, which had a disagreeable sort of attractiveness about it, for you almost immediately felt it to be insoluble, and yet it would not let you rest. He might be the best or the worst of men. Notes to Chapter 7. Additional testimony of Professor and Mrs. De Morgan. Professor De Morgan says, "I gave an account of all this to a friend who was then alive, a man of ologies and ometers both, who was not at all disposed to think it anything but a clever imposture. But," said he, "what you tell me is very singular. I shall go myself to Mrs. Hayden, I shall go alone and not give my name. I don't think I shall hear anything from anybody, but if I do I shall find out the trick. Depend upon it, I shall find it out." He went accordingly, and came to me to report progress. He told me that he had gone a step beyond me, for he had insisted on taking his alphabet behind a large folding screen and asking his questions by the alphabet and a pencil, as well as receiving the answers. No persons except himself and Mrs. Hayden were in the room. The spirit who came to him was one whose unfortunate death was fully detailed in the usual way. My friend told me that he was awestruck, and had nearly forgotten all his precautions. The things which I have narrated were the beginning of a long series of experiences, many as remarkable as what I have given, many of a minor character, separately worth little, but jointly of weight when considered in connection with the more decisive proofs of reality. Many of a confirmatory tendency as mere facts, but of a character not sustentive of the gravity and dignity of the spiritual world. The celebrated apparition of Giles Scroggins is a serious personage compared to some which have fallen in my way, and a logical one, too. If these things be spirits, they show that pretenders, coxcombs and liars are to be found on the other side of the grave as well as on this, and what for no? As Meg Dodds said, "The whole question may receive such persevering attention as shall worm out the real truth, or it may die away, obtaining only casual notice, until a new outburst of phenomena recalls its history of this clay. But this subsidence does not seem to begin. It is now 12 or 13 years since the matter began to be everywhere talked about, during which time there have been many announcements of the total extinction of the spirit mania. But in several cases, as in Tom Moore's fable, the extinguishers have caught fire. Were it the absurdity it is often said to be, it would do much good by calling attention to the manifestations of another absurdity, the philosophy of possibilities and impossibilities, the philosophy of the fourth court. Extremes meet, but the meeting is often for the purpose of mutual exposure, like that of silly gentlemen in the day of pop and paragraph duels. This on the supposition that spiritualism is all either imposture or delusion, it cannot be more certainly one or the other than is the philosophy opposed to it. I have no acquaintance either with P or Q. But I feel sure that the decided conviction of all who can see both sides of the shield must be, that it is more likely that P has seen a ghost than that Q knows he cannot have seen one. I know that Q says he knows it. In this connection the following from the publisher's circular on the appearance of Mrs. De Morgan's book shows a contemporary estimate of Professor De Morgan's critical faculty. Mere literators and writers of fiction may be pardoned for a little tendency to the visionary and unreal, but the fact that the well-known author of the standard works on formal logic, the differential calculus, and the theory of probabilities, should figure with his lady in the characters of believers in spirit trapping and table turning, will probably take most people by surprise. There is perhaps no contributor to our reviews who is more at home in demolishing a fallacy, or in good-humoredly disposing of an ignorant pretender in science than Mr. De Morgan. His clear, logical, witty and whimsical style is readily traced by literary readers in many a striking article in our critical journals. He is probably the last man whom the skeptical in such mysteries would expect to find on the side of Mr. Home and Mrs. Newton Crossland.